And you just heard from Cowboys, the Cowboy Junkies, from their album in 1988 called Trinity Session, was recorded at a I'm drawing a blank for the name of the church. Oh, the Church of the Holy Trinity on November 27th, 1987. It says, with the band circled around a single mic, a mixture of both original music and covers. The legend says that it was recorded in a single day there. I think all but one song. And I don't know, still one of my favorite albums of all time. And there are some covers on there that I like better than the original covers. So, anyway, if you're interested at all, you might want to research that album a little bit and or even just check it out. Anyway, it is now about 1.5 minutes after 5 o'clock. You are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And in the first hour, again, you heard two recordings of talks done by my favorite poet, again, W.S. Merwin. The first was portions of an October 2010 talk he gave at Poets House, and the second, his 2012 TED talk called Connections. Coming up in this hour, I'm featuring another TED talk. This one is with Elizabeth Gilbert, presenting her talk called Your Elusive Creative Genius in 2009, and that was given in Long Beach. And again, after this, after I air this, we're going to have a lot of time to share some more information, and also I'm going to include a fair amount of music as well in this hour, so you'll want to stay tuned for that. And I'm going to feature one artist or one group, duo. So I hope you can stay tuned for all of that. It's just my usual start of the hour announcement that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. So let's go ahead and move into this hour's feature, again, another TED Talk. Again, this one was recorded in Long Beach with Elizabeth Gilbert presenting her talk, Your Elusive Creative Genius. This was done in 2009. And in all honesty, I've heard a lot of TED Talks, but I am really attached to this one as I was to Merwin's also in the first hour. So that's why you're hearing them both today, I guess, apparently. That would make sense. Following again this featured portion, again, you will hear some more music and some local information. Here we go. Here again is Elizabeth Gilbert with her TED Talk, Your Creative Elusive Genius. Get her queued up here, and here we go.
I am a writer. Writing books is my profession, but it's more than that, of course. It is also my great lifelong love and fascination. And I don't expect that that's ever going to change. But that said, something kind of peculiar has happened recently in my life and in my career, which has caused me to have to sort of recalibrate my whole relationship with this work. And the peculiar thing is that I recently wrote this book, this memoir called Eat, Pray, Love, which decidedly unlike any of my previous books, went out in the world for some reason and became this big mega sensation international bestseller thing, the result of which is that everywhere I go now, people treat me like I'm doomed. Seriously, doomed. Doomed. Like, they come up to me now, like, all worried, and they say, aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid you're never going to be able to top that? Aren't you afraid you're going to keep writing for your whole life, and you're never again going to create a book that anybody in the world cares about at all, ever, again? So that's reassuring, you know. But it would be worse, except for that I happen to remember that over 20 years ago, when I first started telling people when I was a teenager that I wanted to be a writer, I was met with this same kind of sort of fear-based reaction, and people would say, aren't you afraid you're never going to have any success? Aren't you afraid the humiliation of rejection will kill you? Aren't you afraid that you're going to work your whole life at this craft and nothing's ever going to come of it, and you're going to die on a scrap heap of broken dreams with your mouth filled with bitter ash of failure? Like that, you know? And the answer, short answer to all those questions is yes. Yes, I'm afraid of all those things. And I always have been. And I'm afraid of many, many more things besides that, you know, people can't even guess at, like seaweed and other things that are scary. But when it comes to writing, the thing that I've been sort of thinking about lately and wondering about lately is why, you know? Is it rational? Is it logical that anybody should be expected to be afraid of the work that they feel they were put on this earth to do, you know? And what is it specifically about creative ventures that seems to make us really nervous about each other's mental health in a way that other careers kind of don't do, you know? Like my dad, for example, was a chemical engineer, and I don't recall once in his 40 years of chemical engineering anybody asking him if he was afraid to be a chemical engineer, you know? It just didn't come, like, got chemical engineering block, John, you know? How's it go? And it just didn't come up like that, you know? But to be fair, right, chemical engineers as a group, you know, haven't really earned a reputation over the centuries for being alcoholic manic depressives, and we writers, you know, we kind of do have that reputation. And not just writers, but creative people across all genres, it seems, have this reputation for being enormously mentally unstable. And, you know, all you have to do is look at the very grim death count in the 20th century alone of really magnificent creative minds who died young and often at their own hands, you know. And even the ones who didn't literally commit suicide seem to be really undone by their gifts, you know. Norman Mailer, just before he died, last interview, he said, every one of my books has killed me a little more. An extraordinary statement to make about your life's work, you know? But we don't even blink when we hear somebody say this because we've heard that kind of stuff for so long, and somehow we've completely internalized and accepted collectively this notion that creativity and suffering are somehow inherently linked, and that artistry, in the end, will always ultimately lead to anguish. And the question that I want to ask everybody here today is, are you guys all cool with that idea? Like, are you comfortable with that? Because you look at it even from an inch away, and, you know, I'm not at all comfortable with that assumption. I think it's odious, and I also think it's dangerous, and I don't want to see it perpetuated into the next century. I think better if we encourage, you know, our great creative minds to live, you know, and I definitely know that in my case, in my situation, it would be very dangerous for me to start sort of leaking down that dark path of assumption, you know, particularly given the circumstance that I'm in right now in my career, which is, you know, like, check it out, I'm pretty young. I'm only about 40 years old. I still have maybe another four decades of work left in me. And it's exceedingly likely that anything I write from this point forward is going to be judged by the world as the work that came after the freakish success of my last book, right? I should just put it bluntly, because we're all sort of friends here now, it's exceedingly likely that my greatest success is behind me, you know? So Jesus, what a thought, you know? Like, that's the kind of thought that could lead a person to start drinking gin at 9 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, I don't want to go there. You know, I would prefer to keep doing this work that I love. And so the question becomes how, you know? And so it seems to me, upon a lot of reflection, that the way that I have to work now in order to continue writing is that I have to create some sort of protective psychological construct, right? I have to sort of find some way to have a safe distance, you know, between me as I am writing and my very natural anxiety about what the reaction to that writing is going to be from now on. And as I've been looking over the last year for like models for how to do that, I've been sort of looking across time and I've been trying to find like other societies to see if they might have had better and saner ideas than we have about how to help creative people sort of manage the inherent emotional risks of creativity. And that search has led me to ancient Greece and ancient Rome. So stay with me because it does circle around back. But ancient Greece and ancient Rome, people did not happen to believe that creativity came from human beings back then, okay? People believed that creativity was this divine attendant spirit that came to human beings from some distant and unknowable source for distant and unknowable reasons. The Greeks famously called these divine attendant spirits of creativity daemons. Socrates famously believed that he had a daemon who spoke wisdom to him from afar. The Romans had the same idea, but they called that sort of disembodied creative spirit a genius, which is great because the Romans did not actually think that a genius was a particularly clever individual. They believed that a genius was this sort of magical divine entity who was believed to literally live in the walls of an artist's studio, kind of like Dobby, the house elf, and who would come out and sort of invisibly assist the artist with their work and would shape the outcome of that work. So brilliant. There it is, right there, that distance that I'm talking about, that psychological construct to protect you from the results of your work, you know? And everyone knew that this is how it functioned, right? So the ancient artist was protected from certain things like, for example, too much narcissism, right? If your work was brilliant, couldn't take all the credit for it. Everybody knew you had this like disembodied genius who had helped you. If your work bombed, not entirely your fault, you know? Everyone knew your genius was kind of lame. And this is how people thought about creativity in the West for a really long time. And then the Renaissance came and everything changed and we had this big idea. And the big idea was, let's put the individual human being at the center of the universe, right? Above all gods and mysteries. And there's no more room for like mystical creatures who take dictation from the divine. And it's the beginning of rational humanism. And people started to believe that creativity came completely from the self of the individual. And for the first time in history, you start to hear people referring to this or that artist as being a genius rather than having a genius. And I gotta tell you, I think that was a huge error. You know, I think that allowing somebody, like one mere person, to believe that he or she is like the vessel, you know, like the font and the essence and the source of all divine, creative, unknowable, eternal mystery is just like a smidge too much responsibility to put on one fragile human psyche. It's like asking somebody to swallow the sun, you know? It just completely warps and distorts egos, and it creates all these unmanageable expectations about performance. And I think the pressure of that has been killing off our artists for the last 500 years. And if this is true, and I think it is true, the question becomes, you know, what now? You know, can we do this differently? Maybe go back to some more ancient understanding about the relationship between humans and the creative mystery. Maybe not, you know, like maybe we can't just erase 500 years of rational humanistic thought in one 18-minute speech. And there's probably people in this audience who would raise like really legitimate scientific suspicions about the notion of basically fairies who follow people around like rubbing fairy juice on their projects and stuff. Like, I'm not probably going to bring you all along with me on this. But the question that I kind of want to pose is, you know, why not? Why not think about it this way? Because it makes as much sense as anything else I have ever heard in terms of explaining the utter maddening capriciousness of the creative process, a process which, as anybody who has ever tried to make something, which is to say, as basically everyone here knows, does not always behave rationally, and in fact can sometimes feel downright paranormal. I had this encounter recently where I met the extraordinary American poet Ruth Stone, who's now in her 90s, but she's been a poet her entire life, and she told me that when she was growing up in rural Virginia, she would be out working in the fields, and she said she would like feel and hear a poem coming at her from over the landscape, and she said it was like a thunderous train of air. air, and it would come barreling down at her over the landscape. And when she felt it coming, because it would like shake the earth under her feet, she knew that she had only one thing to do at that point, and that was to, in her words, run like hell. And she would like run like hell to the house, and she'd be getting chased by this poem. And the whole deal was that she had to get to a piece of paper and a pencil fast enough so that when it thundered through her, she could collect it and grab it on the page. And other times she wouldn't be fast enough, so she'd be like running and running and running, and she wouldn't get to the house, and the poem would like barrel through her and she would miss it. And she said it would continue on across the landscape looking, as she put it, for another poet. And then there were these times, this is the piece I never forgot. She said that there were moments when she would almost miss it, right? So she's like running into the house and she's looking for the paper, and the poem passes through her and she grabs a pencil just as it's going through her. And then she said it was like she would reach out with her other hand and she would catch it. She would catch the poem by its tail and she would pull it backwards into her body as she was transcribing on the page. And in these instances, the poem would come up on the page perfect and intact, but backwards from the last word to the first. So when I heard that, I was like, that's uncanny. That's exactly what my creative process is like. It's not at all what my creative process, I'm not the pipeline, you know, like I'm a mule. And the way that I have to work is that I have to get up at the same time every day and like sweat and labor and like barrel through it really awkwardly. But even I, in my mulishness, even I have brushed up against that thing, you know, at times. And I would imagine that a lot of you have too. You know, like even I have had work or ideas come through me from a source that I honestly cannot identify. And what is that thing? And how are we to relate to it in a way that will not make us lose our minds, but in fact might actually keep us sane? And for me, the best contemporary example that I have of how to do that is the musician Tom Waits, who I got to interview several years ago on a magazine assignment. And we were talking about this. And, you know, Tom, I mean, for most of his life, he was pretty much the embodiment of the tormented contemporary modern artist, you know, like trying to control and manage and dominate these sort of uncontrollable creative impulses, you know, that were totally internalized. But then he got older and he got calmer. And one day he was driving down the freeway in Los Angeles, he told me, and this is when it all changed for him. And he's like speeding along, and all of a sudden he hears this little fragment of melody, you know, that comes into his head, as inspiration often comes, elusive and tantalizing, and he wants it, you know, it's gorgeous, and he longs for it, but he has no way to get it. He doesn't have a piece of paper, he doesn't have a pencil, he doesn't have a tape recorder. So he starts to feel all that old anxiety start to rise in him, like, I'm gonna lose this thing, you know, and then I'm gonna be haunted by this song forever, and I'm not good enough, and I can't do it. And instead of panicking, he just stopped that whole mental process, and he did something completely novel. He just looked up at the sky and he said, "Excuse me, can you not see that I'm driving? Do I look like I can write down a song right now? You know, if you really want to exist, come back at a more opportune moment when I can take care of you. Otherwise, go bother somebody else today. Go bother Leonard Cohen, you know?" And his whole work process changed after that. Not the work. The work was still like oftentimes as dark as ever, you know? But the process and the heavy anxiety around it was released when he took the genie, the genius, out of him, where it was causing nothing but trouble, and released it kind of back where it came from, and realized that this didn't have to be this internalized, tormented thing. It could be this peculiar, wondrous, bizarre collaboration, kind of conversation between Tom and the strange external thing that was not quite Tom. So when I heard that story, it started to shift a little bit the way that I worked too, and it already saved me once, this idea. It saved me when I was in the middle of writing Eat, Pray, Love, and I fell into one of those sort of pits of despair that we all fall into when we're working on something and it's not coming, and you start to think this is going to be a disaster, this is going to be the worst book ever written. Not just bad, but the worst book ever written. And I started to think I should just dump this project, you know? But then I remembered Tom talking to the open air, and I tried it. So I just lifted my face up from the manuscript and I directed my comments to an empty corner of the room, and I said aloud, "Listen, you thing, you and I both know that if this book isn't brilliant, that is not entirely my fault, right? Because you can see that I am putting everything I have into this. You know, I don't have any more than this. So if you want it to be better, then you got to show up and do your part of the deal, okay? But if you don't do that, you know what, the hell with it, I'm gonna keep writing anyway because that's my job. And I would please like the record to reflect today that I showed up for my part of the job." Because, thank you. In the end, it's like this, okay? Centuries ago, in the deserts of North Africa, people used to gather for these moonlight dances of sacred dance and music that would go on for hours and hours until dawn. And they were always magnificent because the dancers were professionals and they were terrific, right? But every once in a while, very rarely, something would happen and one of these performers would actually become transcendent. And I know you know what I'm talking about because I know you've all seen at some point in your life a performance like this, you know? And it was like time would stop and the dancer would sort of step through some kind of portal, and he wasn't doing anything different than he had ever done, you know, 1,000 nights before, but everything would align, and all of a sudden, he would no longer appear to be merely human. You know, he would be, like, lit from within and lit from below and all, like, lit up on fire with divinity. And when this happened back then, people knew it for what it was, you know? They called it by its name. They would put their hands together, and they would start to chant, Allah, 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 God. God, 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 that's God, you know? Curious historical footnote. When the Moors invaded southern Spain, they took this custom with them, and the pronunciation changed over the centuries from Allah, Allah, Allah to ole, 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 which you still hear in bullfights and in flamenco dances in Spain when a performer has done something impossible and magic. Allah, ole, ole, Allah, magnificent, bravo, incomprehensible, there it is, a glimpse of God. Which is great, because we need that. But the tricky bit comes the next morning, right, for the dancer himself, when he wakes up and discovers that it's Tuesday at 11 a.m. and he's no longer a glimpse of God. He's just an aging mortal with really bad knees, and, you know, maybe he's never going to ascend to that height again, and maybe nobody will ever chant God's name again as he spins, and what is he then to do with the rest of his life? This is hard. This is one of the most painful reconciliations to make in a creative life, you know? But maybe it doesn't have to be quite so full of anguish if you never happened to believe in the first place that the most extraordinary aspects of your being came from you. But maybe if you just believed that they were on loan to you, you know, from some unimaginable source for some exquisite portion of your life to be passed along when you're finished with somebody else. And you know, if we think about it this way, it starts to change everything, you know? This is how I've started to think, and this is certainly how I was thinking about it in the last few months, you know, as I've been working on the book that will soon be published as the dangerously, frighteningly over-anticipated follow-up to my freakish success. And what I have to sort of keep telling myself when I get really psyched out about that is don't be afraid. Don't be daunted. Just do your job. Continue to show up for your piece of it, whatever that might be. If your job is to dance, do your dance. If the divine cockeyed genius assigned to your case decides to let some sort of wonderment be glimpsed for just one moment through your efforts, then ole. And if not, do your dance anyhow. And ole to you nonetheless. I believe this and I feel like we must teach it. Ole to you nonetheless, just for having the sheer human love and stubbornness to keep showing up. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And you just heard the TED Talk I featured, the second TED Talk today. This one, Elizabeth Gilbert presenting her talk, Your Elusive Creative Genius. That was done in 2009. I'm going to do like what I did in the first hour. It's very similar. I'm going to play a song now. It's going to be Mazzy Star off of their So Tonight That I Might See album. The song is called Blue Light. Here we go. Just heard Mazzy Star from their 2013. No, that's the wrong one. Their 1993 album called So Tonight That I Might See. You heard the song called Blue Light and Hope Sandoval on vocals. I also think I read something where she's putting together some new music again, so that would be wonderful. And I'm going to play some more Mazzy Star to take us out of here later in the hour. I do want to also share a bunch more upcoming events and maybe review calls for submissions again, too, as well, because I think I might have enough time to do that. We'll see. Anyway, the one thing I should do now, let's do this, and I will be right back.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Did you recognize that sound? That's the sound of a healthy, well-cared-for cat. I truly hope you've been lucky enough to hear that sound before. The feral cat population around Kingston and the surrounding areas has grown considerably over the last few years. And thanks to organizations like Kendra's Community Kitties, these feral cats are being fed, medically cared for, spayed, neutered, flea treated, dewormed, given winter shelters, and placed in loving homes whenever possible.
Hundreds of these special animals have been rescued by Kendra, and many of these wonderful felines are purring right now, safe and healthy.
But rescuing and rehoming feral cats isn't easy. It requires an enormous amount of time and effort, and there are a few ways you can help.
You can donate to Kendra's Community Kitties on their website, kckitties.com. Even a small amount will help pay for medication, spay and neutering procedures, and food and supplies to keep these felines sheltered and healthy in the cold winters or extreme heat of the summer. Because some of these kitties are not socialized, Kendra has committed herself to provide 22 dishes of food with fresh water every day, 365 days a year, to six feral colonies. Food prices have increased significantly, so donations of food and money are always needed. Funding assists with the process of finding homes for these cats as well, as it takes time and money to find the right individual or family to be matched with the right kind of cat. You can become a foster family for our feline friends. Go to kckitties.com and learn how you can care for and love a cat or even a family of kittens until they can be moved into their forever homes. At the colonies, Kendra plants the seeds of trust and socializes the feral felines when she brings them food at the same time each and every single day. So they're more accepting of humans when placed with foster families. But fostering a feral cat is no easy task. Kendra cannot take these cats from the colonies unless there are foster homes willing to commit to help these kitties gain trust with humans.
You can adopt one of these special cats or kittens. If you've already been thinking of getting a furry friend, reach out to Kendra at kckitties.com and she'll provide you with all the information you need to make this important decision.
Any help you can offer Kendra's Community Kitties will be tremendously appreciated. Not only by Kendra, but by the lucky feral felines she rescues.
And hey, maybe, just maybe, one day you'll get to hear
Panda say I love you.
Two out of three geese. Six out of seven seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
And you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And again, you are listening to Finding a Voice. And just a quick reminder that every week, both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. We'll remain there for 3 years. And I do plan on airing, I'm actually going to air a couple of songs back to back at the end of the hour because we do have a lot of time here and I've still got 15 minutes where I can probably will run out of things to say. So I think that's the way I'm going to do it today. So, but going to play some more Mazzy Star at the end. It is, if I didn't bring it up already, about 30, almost now 36 minutes after 5 o'clock. And I'm going to, again, I might come back to those first three In fact, I know what? I'm just going to do that in case you didn't tune in. I know there are some people that could only tune into the second hour today. So I'm going to just the first three calls for submissions that are expiring this weekend, if not today. So just to give everybody another heads up. Again, first is our poetry's Award of Awesomeness. Again, this is a monthly monthly contest, and it's always the last day. The deadline is the last day of each month. It's open to everybody. Prize, 50% of prize money raised, and a rare vintage award item. For the link for all the information and the prompt and everything you need to know, ARC, and again, that's ARC, arcpoetry.ca, /contest/ARC Award of Awesomeness. Again, that deadline is today, so I'm assuming they would give you until midnight tonight. The second one is, the deadline is tomorrow, Saturday, February 1st. ARC, again, ARC Poetry, it's their annual contest for their poem, ARC Poem of the Year Award. And it offers $5,000 for the winning poem, $500 for honorable mention, and $250 for Reader's Choice selection. It says all 10 to 12 shortlisted poems receive paid publication in ARC and online. Details, arcpoetry.ca again, and /contest/poem of the year. Again, that deadline is tomorrow, February 1st. Masters Review, Winter Short Story Award for new writers. Deadline for that is Sunday, February 2nd. This is not quoted verbatim, but pretty close. From their website, it says this contest runs February 2nd and is open to any writer who has not yet published a novel or memoir with a major press. They are looking for unpublished fiction or creative nonfiction, 6,000 words max. One of the first place receives $3,000 and publication and agency review. Second and third places receive $300 and $200 online publication and agency review. For full guidelines and details, go to mastersreview.com/Winter Short Story Award for new writers. And again, that deadline is Sunday, February 2nd. I will briefly go over the first upcoming events because I did that very quickly in the first hour. And again, if you just tuned in the second hour, you would need to know this because these are coming up very quickly too. And it's not like I will get another chance to share them with you like I might next week for later events. Lit Live is in Hamilton, and they're at the Staircase Cafe and Theater, 27 Dundurn Street North in Hamilton. They are usually the first Sunday evening of each month from September through June. The door is pay what you can. They do suggest $5 to $10. Details, go to their Facebook page and you will get everything you need to know there. And then coming up on this Tuesday, it's there are several things. Well, one of them is an every Tuesday event, and it's in Toronto. It's called Write On Right Now, but it's WRITE, so Write On exclamation point, Right Now exclamation point. They meet 7 p.m. every Tuesday evening. Go to their Facebook page. You'll get much more information there. They meet at the Bampot House of Tea, which is at 201 Harbord Street in Toronto, Tuesdays. The next one. So the next one coming up is February 4th, 7 to 9 p.m. And then in Madoc, their first Tuesday night of the month event, open mic, is called First Tuesday Muse. And they meet in Madoc with host TJ Best. Their Facebook page is the place to go for information and updates. So go there. It happens at Finn's Pub and Patio, 231 Durham Street South in Madoc. And then here in Kingston, the first monthly, the first Tuesday reading series, the monthly open mic called And the Journey Continues, began 2009, has run. This doesn't seem possible that we've been going that long. It's a beautiful event, and it's run continuously since. As a first Tuesday night of the month reading series, we meet now. This is our fifth venue, I believe, fourth or fifth venue at the Elm Cafe, but we've been there for a number of years, well before the pandemic even started. So the Elm Cafe, which is at 303 Montreal Street here in Kingston, runs from 7 to 9:15 p.m., Tuesday, February 4th. Doors do open at 6:30. I do suggest you get there early to get a seat. And see what else we've got going on here. On air, let's see if I've got enough information. I do. This is coming up February 9th, and it's actually connected here to CFRC. It's the YGK residency program, and it says, Abby Louise, this is a quote, Abby Louise is a grateful participant in CFRC's YGK residency program. She is a Kingston-based musician, artist, poet, and community organizer from Atlanta. You'll hear her in interview and with a performance. Her music is mellow, blends R&B, neo-soul, and indie folk with thought-provoking lyrics that reflect on connectedness to each other and the natural world. That's from her poster. It airs locally on air, streams live online at www.cfrc.ca. It is archived there as well. And also related Instagram accounts are at CFRC Music and at underscore Voice of Abby. And again, that's happening Sunday, February 9th. So a week from Sunday at 1 p.m. Multi-genre event. This has been going on for, you know, I don't know if it's been 2 years yet, but it's been quite a while. So this is pretty cool. It's Quirks of Human Nature. It's poetry performed with improvised music. It is a monthly event. It is now it used to be a third Monday night of the month series, but it's moved now, I believe, permanently as a second Monday night of the month series. I will be the featured poet, I guess, this month. And the guitarist will be Will Van Ryn, and Deb Sherman's is piano and is also the co-MC. Bonus poets are Selena Shirelli, Allison Castillo Chisholm, and also Alana Veach. And Meg Freer organizes that event and MCs it as well. Does all of the publication or most a good portion of the promotion of getting the word out. And that's coming up Monday, February 10th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. It happens at the Royal Tavern 2.0, which is located at 344 Princess Street here in Kingston. Coming up then on February 12th, that would be the Wednesday night that week, Antonia Julianne Okot-Bitak will be launching her new novel called We the Kindling. This will be happening in the Grand Ballroom of the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. Novel Idea Bookstore will be on hand with copies. And I got this information. You can also find, you may find other information as well, maybe through Queens on Facebook, or maybe just Google that whole thing. But also, Novel Idea is really good about providing updates of events they're tied to on their Facebook page. So go there as well. And also, I just found out that Hosting that event that evening will be Kingston Poet Laureate Sadiqa Demeyer. Coming up on the show here next week, I believe, I should have brought that up sooner, actually, is going to be probably, I'm hoping that it will be the readings from the January open mic. I usually try to get that done the week before, but it didn't happen this week. So coming next week, that's what you'll hear on the show. So that will be on the 7th, February 7th. Let's see what else we've got here that's coming up. Another one, and I mentioned Abby Miole already as Abby Louise, Abby Miole does second Friday night of the month open mic event, and that is a monthly event that's been going on for several months already. It is a quote from their page. It says, "This is a non-judgmental space open to all ages and walks of life to listen to or to share music, poetry, and short stories. Each person will have 5 to 15 minutes to share. Just depends on the number of people who are there and signed up." It says, if you have questions, contact abbymiole at gmail.com. That's ABBIEMIOLEE. Doors open at 7, and it runs from 7:30 to 9. This is at Next Church at 89 Colburn Street in Kingston. And let's see what else we've got here. Kind of going through here, trying to find something that would be. There is a book launch coming up at Novel Idea. This is on February 26th. So we're starting to get out there a ways. And there may be more things coming up too. But this one is all planned and locked in. Kate, and I hope it might be Guys, but it's G-E-I-S, will be launching and reading from her memoir, It Must Be Beautiful to Be Finished. Again, watch for updates on Novel Ideas Bookstore's Facebook page. And they also have an Instagram page as well. I think they keep them both up to date. Also coming up soon, the Kingston Canadian Film Festival for 2025 will be coming up. February 26th will run, February 26th through March 2nd. And with that, I think I'm going to start to just, I think I've pretty much covered most of the current things or the most upcoming things. I'll have a chance to plug the rest of them. It is getting almost to be 49 minutes after 5 o'clock. I have about 10 minutes of music to take us out of here. So I do want to thank all of you very much for having tuned into the show today. I hope you enjoyed the TED Talks, this bit of music that I don't really get a chance to share very often. So I played some of the music that I like, and I hope you like it too. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, here every Friday from 4 to 6 o'clock. Stream live online as well, www.cfrc.ca. Both hours are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Remain there for 3 years. Please do stay tuned for 2 hours of East Coast music and a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Cornell. That comes up right at the top of this hour. As soon as I finish these songs, I'm going to play 2 songs by Mazzy Star off of their Seasons of Your Day album. You're going to hear Sparrow and Spoon back to back. Have a great week, everybody.
Don't give me your thing. Look at me with your cold eyes. You know what I'm saying. If say. I got a heart like a sparrow. I'm just mine. Just like a play, and now a kind word would soothe you. And a smile from my heart would suffice. Used to say, I'll be fine on my own. Give me one bottle of wine and two.
Bye.